From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For decades, Jerry Parker kept a manuscript under her bed. It was a story she would work on from time to time about her encounter with a boy named Carlos. She met him when she was 24. He was 10. She taught him language at a high school in Ogden. He was born deaf. She was writing a memoir about the years she knew Carlos. She became his teacher, his protector. She was with him when he died young of a kidney disease. Jerry Parker helped Carlos learn to speak, but really it was Carlos who gave her a deeper understanding of what it means to communicate. She has said it was the beginning of her understanding about the limits and the potential of human language. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting her conversation with Jerry Parker about her book called A Thousand Voices. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Utah artist and educator and writer Jerry Parker. We're talking about her book. It's a memoir called A Thousand Voices. She taught high school and university for a number of years, but Carlos Luis Salazar is the student, she says, that haunted her dreams. He was 10 when she first met him. She was 24. He was wild-hearted, a bit of a hellion, without language. He was born deaf. Jerry says, though, he was the one that taught her. She's described Carlos as the beginning of her understanding, really, about the limits and the potential of human language, but also about the depth of accepting and belonging and defining yourself. And Jerry Parker, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, I wanted to start with when you first there's a story you tell in the book about and we should say Carlos because you really begin with telling about Carlos's funeral. He died rather young, and we'll talk about that as we go, but. But you spoke at his funeral, and you write about how afterward his son, Charlie, comes up to you. You write about how he had this amazement in his eyes. And you say after that, this is how you put it in the book, that you kept track of Carlos's life, of what you remembered about him. What do you mean? Was it Charlie that made you think that you needed to keep track of it? Were you writing it? What do you mean exactly?
It was Charlie that made me think... He doesn't know these things about his father.
Yeah.
What he would have heard about his father would have been negative. And it was so obviously moving to him. And he suddenly became that unknown story that's emblematic in so many ways of a lot of the concerns of our time.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to lose track of him myself, what I remembered. So it was just luxury to... jot down scenes. He'd written a lot of cards to me, a lot of letters,
yeah.
Drew those wonderful pictures. And I never got tired of the material. It had the range of touching, but tough and real, too.
So. You know what's so extraordinary is how vivid it all is. And I'm trying to imagine you kind of recollecting it, it must have sort of come back to life. I don't imagine you wrote it down at the time, but you were reliving this. Did it come back easily?
It came back easily, and it still does. I can still just exactly hear his voice. It was something about him that was so vivid and so memorable. And he'd cast himself in these modes, vignettes. He could be a dauphin one minute and an anarchist the next. You wondered where he came from with that kind of range, and where did he learn the courtly manners he could move into? So he just held your attention, and it was indelible.
You say about when you started writing about this, you said, I didn't make any demands on myself, unities, continuity, any of that. You said, I just let Carlos take me as he always had. So what does that mean? I'm just going to write and see what comes of it.
Just go with it.
Yeah.
Let him come back. It's also a damn good literary ploy.
Is that what do you mean? just to let it flow?
I think I wanted the reader to see it as that, almost a scrapbook. Just turn the pages and let him come off the page. No intention here to have a midterm for you somewhere.
So would you write every couple of days, every so often about it when something came to you? How was
it? You know, the truth is, Doug, it was more every couple of decades.
Yeah.
I was making a living. I had a lot going on. I was working on another book that I saw as my magnum opus. And for refreshment, for joy, I would come back to this one. One day I said to myself, you know, you might notice the horse you're on here is a pretty good ride.
Yeah.
So it was both. I'd work on it for a stretch. I think a very good thing happened in that I worked slowly. I wanted to get to the remembered in tranquility stage. That doesn't happen quickly. And I didn't want it to be sentimental above all things. I wanted it to be tough and real. So I'd put it away, and when I'd come back to it, I'd see a whole other thing. The sub-story would start to emerge. I went to New Mexico when he was dying. I thought, I just want to make the trip he didn't make.
Yeah.
He wanted to go back to where his people were from. Walked the arroyos, looked at it all, and it just came upon me. My people took this land away from his people. He never would have heard these stories. He wouldn't have heard of Escalante and Dominguez, and wanted to bring back something forever for his people, for his son.
You, when did you know that, oh, I think it's finished, you know? I mean, it was, I don't know if it was actually under your bed. I think you've described it as being under your bed, or it was somewhere anyway. You
it was under my bed somewhere. For a long time.
Yeah, and then... But at what point did you figure, all right, I've got to be done with this, or I've got to finish this?
There was a real moment. I thought, it's just as it needs to be. I had a curious little way of judging it. I have chickens, and I had them before they were trendy, or I wouldn't even mention them. But I would take a piece out there. I made myself a nice little place to read to them. It was kind of a chicken palace. And if they would get wrapped and come around and sit and watch me and do that soft gabble, then I thought, this piece will float. If they paid no attention at all, I'd go back to work.
Wow.
And it would mesmerize me, calm me, and I could hear it. And they had to do it with a straight face, reading there to chickens. And if you couldn't do it with a straight face, you thought, there's more yet to be done here. That was my final audience before I turned it over.
Talk about there's this story you tell when you first – I mean, you first encountered him at a fundraising event, and you were struck by him there. But then there's this moment when you see him leaping in a – is it a field of sunflowers? And that seemed to be the kind of – captivating moment for you.
It was a captivating moment. And if it had been a field of sunflowers, it would have been relieving to me. It was an asphalt driveway with three or four great, huge sunflowers 12 inches across. And he was leaping as though he were a little monkey in the jungle. He would spring up to the tops of those sunflowers and make a perfect jackknife. You could see him love it and plant it and arch, touch his toes, and crash downward. And there was enough foliage that I couldn't see his head for a minute, but I thought, he's going to hit that asphalt like a watermelon. I was standing by for triage. And then it'd be very quiet for a minute. I thought, I don't believe what I saw. He can't have gone as high as I thought he went. And then there he was again, springing into the wildflowers. He celebrated life, and he loved being Carlos Luis Salazar. He was small and fleet, and he made use of it.
So you take him for a drive. This was this idea of taking him up the canyon, a place you knew all too well. He jumps right in the back. You tried to get him to go in the front, I guess, but he wanted to be in the back. You were fine with that, I guess. But I want to have you read this section, because this is something you say. You said, I had no notion how to talk to a deaf 10-year-old. So, because I think this is important before you read this. I mean, this is your first you're confused about how am I going to communicate with this kid, right?
Yeah, right. It's why I wanted him in the front seat so he could partially see me. He'd had a good teacher by the time I met him, and he was beginning to be a good lip reader, but just barely. He didn't have any language training at all until he was 5 or 6, which is, as you know, almost impossible to acquire language at that point.
Please.
Carlos was plastered against the window of my old yellow Scout, studying the trees and rocky slopes. He was intent and busy in his observations, flipping from one side of the car to the other in order not to miss anything. He was as lively as the small darting creatures he saw in the forest. I noticed that he was unmindful of me, and I was glad I hadn't subdued him. We were in evergreens almost as soon as we left the big homes of the East Bench. The turn up into the canyon took us away from city things. Houses and schools and 7-Elevens were replaced by pines and firs and a few spruce. Their canopies sheltered fox and coyotes, moose and bear, as well as squirrels and chipmunks. Mule deer darted in and out of the shadows. We'd see their white tails, and then our eyes would sort the rest of them out from the branches they were lost in. I put the window down just enough to let the tangy scent of the trees and the wildflowers come in. At the crest of the pass, we parked the car and got out. The air was cool and smelled of damp earth and grasses, as well as evergreens. Carlos and I made our way along a mountain trail, and I began to learn what language is and what it isn't. Since my business was teaching it, I was riveted. Those hours of that first day with him reconfigured everything I thought I knew. One observation was how much of communication takes place outside words. The merest movement, no more it seemed to me than the anticipation of exchange, brought a nod and grin from Carlos. It was one of the most wholehearted gestures left in the West. Carlos stopped beside a little yellow flower. I lifted its hood with my finger. "This is the first flower in spring," I said. "Spring," he mouthed, but didn't say. "A yellow violet. We call them dog tooths." I put a couple of fingers over a tooth. "Dog tooth," I continued, and I got down on the ground like a dog. I was laughing. I wasn't so abandoned as not to be dealing with an image of myself on all fours in the grass, like the tooth of a dog. I hoped I hadn't knocked the ecstasy out of seeing a delicate little flower. Carlos was skipping, and my own laugh changed to a broad smile. I could see he was, if not edified, then not confounded. He was a good player.
This was so interesting to me because you talk about, as you say, it reconfigured everything you thought you knew. What do you mean exactly? Can you say what you mean exactly?
I think I can. I'd seen him communicate with his mother on the porch, and there was no signing. There were gestures, the movement of a shoulder, an eyebrow, an eye. It was swift, and it was powerful, and you felt it. It reminded me of the language you'd see in the forest between animals. You know, they've taken in a whole lot of information, and you don't know how. And I sat there watching that and thinking language is so varied, it's so unknowable in many of its forms, and maybe we're more limited by language than we are defined by it. Maybe there are ways to communicate that those of us with words have been restricted by.
Yeah.
And I began just to think of its limits, its limitlessness, its way of defining, of describing, maybe also of categorizing, certainly of categorizing, placing us in tiers. And I could see that what I did in an English classroom or a French classroom was easy stuff.
Yeah.
They'd get it with me or without me. But now we were down to where everything would count.
I paid
attention.
That's what I wanted to say. It seemed like that's the thing that you were – there was an awareness.
Yeah.
It's like language almost – words are almost a crutch. But for Carlos, he had to see it. He had to be aware, I guess, to communicate.
Exactly. And the things that you could see, virtually see, weren't so hard for him. You could say to him, this is a pencil.
Yeah.
Pencil.
Yeah.
And he could watch that. We got to Montreal. I took him to Montreal, really, to get him out of some trouble. He was in Ogden, and he had a bike, and he knew the word bike. And someone stole his bike. So he came up furious. Nothing bike. I said, someone stole your bike. He couldn't understand that at all.
Hmm. What do you mean? He couldn't understand the concept?
Stole.
Stole.
Show me.
Yeah.
So I think it was the other way around, actually. Someone messed with his bike. Well, he after that had happened, he stole a bike.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I said, you broke the law. That's big trouble. He knew big trouble. Nothing broke. I don't see nothing broke. What's broke? And I said, the law. And I was desperate. You're trying to think how to do it. I got out the Encyclopedia Britannica and showed him the heads of parliament, the little circles, and they're all sitting in Ottawa.
Wow.
Trying to say they're at a table. These are men. Nothing men. And say, they make the rules that make the laws. Finally, I went downstairs and stole his bike. And I said, why don't you go down and see if your bike's okay? And he came back and he said, nothing bike. And I said, somebody broke the law. And then he could see when it was acted out. You can't do that for every abstract word in the language, but at least there's that moment. It's a Helen Keller moment in a way where he could see there's meaning behind things I'm not going to see. It's not going to be demonstrable.
Yeah. I want to have you finish this section, if you would, too. This is you. You head down to a reservoir, and he comes down by the water. And it's interesting because what you say is you talk about having this. I'm not sure how to describe it. You talk about having this kind of seeing him made you want to protect him, like this moment you thought. What was that? That you wanted to all of a sudden you like it's like I'm in
right.
Now.
Right.
Is that it?
I was in for the long haul.
Yeah.
Right at once. I'd lost a child. I was looking for a son, but there was something so elfin. He was very small, fleet. He seemed so enormously vulnerable. He had a kind of braggadocio about him, and you knew that's what it was. Oh, I think I always just wanted to be sure this defenseless, deaf, little, already half-orphaned child had someone to protect him.
Read the section.
We drove down the mountain pass toward Huntsville, the river still surging to one side of us. When the road leveled out in the valley, we saw we were in fields and farmland, the glittering reservoir below, Pineview Dam in sight. New wheat barley, 5 inches tall, lay spread like a pale green blanket almost to the water's edge. I took a little dirt side road that got us fairly close to a secluded beach on the shores of the reservoir. Carlos had opened the car door before I had it fully stopped, and he was at the water's edge before I could catch up to him. I was hollering cautions, but then my voice fell silent. I realized was already extinguished for Carlos. He was now unreachable. If he wasn't looking, he had no speech to read or gesture to take in, as well as no sound to warn. I felt again that overwhelming concern for him and how precarious his route through life would be. By the time I hurried to where he was, Carlos was sitting in the sand, as natural as water itself, watching the waves come in, one upon the other, and dissolve. Delicate as light, his hand recreated the enigmatic motion of the water rolling and then folding into itself. It remains the only adequate explanation I've had of a wave. Yes, I heard him say in a high, fleeting voice. So there he was, the pure thing, exulting in the great fact of life. That was what it was to know Carlos Luis Salazar at age 10. The turn of his head, the great curious look he spent on everything about him had disarmed me in an afternoon. I had heard him say one word, but he had 1,000 voices I was yet to hear.
Jerry Parker is with us. Her book is 1,000 Voices, and we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with artist and educator and writer Jerry Parker. Her book is called 1,000 Voices, a memoir, and she's with us to talk about it. I wanted to ask you about something you write in the book, because you say that you haven't always been able to sort out the exact reason you were drawn to Carlos Luis Salazar, and you describe him as more otherworldly than childlike. You know, he had, on some levels, he had this sense of indestructibility, this sense of assurance. He was charming. But you're not exactly sure what it was. And it wasn't just him being childlike. What was the otherworldly part that you think about him?
I think in a way for me, he was like something you'd summoned, like the dark-eyed Pepe that comes to everyone's dreams, I think I say in the book, the imagined child. He was like an archetype of a child. You probably endow the child with that to some degree, but there was something in him that was so charged, so compelling that he'd walk into a room and he owned the room. He could lead people to do anything. He had a mystical power. Almost no one was immune to it. And you just watched that almost an illusion of something you couldn't dream you would be possible to see where he's going to take that, yeah. Where he's going to go with his life.
You mentioned earlier that he was the son that you didn't have or couldn't have. You were in an accident. You don't say much about this in the book, but you say you were drawn by this idea of what your life as a mother might have been. And you write this, you write, looking back, I feel mercy for the woman I was.
I like that sentence. I worked a long time on getting that sentence brief and short. I liked the woman I was. I liked what I extended to him. I liked that I endured through really hard times. I didn't think we'd end up friends when adolescence swept through him like a very rigorous bit of surf.
You called it a fury at some point.
Fury. I felt mercy for the heavy look at human life it is, how tough, how raw, how unfair, how much he had against him in ethnic background, in disability, in poverty, and He had so much circumscribing his options, and I felt mercy for the woman who understood where he was.
You were teaching at Weber High School at the time you met Carlos, and you were good at it. I mean, you were popular. You were engaged with it. What did you love about teaching?
It's the one job I've had in all my life that I never get tired of, never felt bored with it or like, well, I've done that. There were so many unpredictables out there. if Susie wore that pink Angora sweater, it might be a really hard day. And if Drew had a headache, he had to do certain things to make it hold together. And I liked the arena of ideas. I taught a poem to deaf children, Fire and Ice, Robert Frost poem, and you could see them get that. Some say the world will end in fire. Very simple language, and just the awakening, the sense of, oh. I love teaching. I liked the kids. They amused me. They made me feel on the edge of something that was just about to happen.
Yeah. And Carlos, you write about, you introduced him to Shakespeare. I mean, you say in the book that you tried to imagine seeing Macbeth without hearing Macbeth.
I'm fascinated that I took him on a bus from Ogden to Salt Lake with all my high school students to see Macbeth. I think it was a terrific thing to do, and he was wide-eyed and, of course, just charming everyone around him. But I knew what he liked on television. He loved Mission Impossible. He was a slave to Mission Impossible. There's just so much action, so much going on. And I thought, well, of all the plays, Macbeth is not one where someone's ruminating in a soliloquy. There are knives, scorpions, daggers. And he was still in it. And that great curtain swooshed down. My whole attention was on what did he think? Where was he? And his comment was, a little bit too much. I thought he meant the costuming. He's, no, he'd seen this in the movies. Oh, what's the matter with this woman?
Wow.
So he got it. What's the matter with this woman? Funny to hear. My students were enthralled to hear Lady Macbeth spoken of as, what's the matter with this woman?
Wow. You know, it's interesting because you talk about how you say this, that the child in love with childhood, school is the first bridal. And so you're trying to imagine, and it seems like this must have been something you thought about a lot when you were teaching, imagining what Carlos would have been like without being bridled by something like, so I mean, he needed education on one hand, but you're trying to think of what would Carlos, and I guess by extension any child, would be like with an undiluted spirit. Do you know what I mean? Because you say maybe commanding interest of a child is the worst thing that can happen to a teacher.
Deaf children at the time I was teaching him looked like you and me. You look cute in your earphones, Doug. Do I look that good?
Yeah, you do.
Carlos wore these big, heavy earphones. All of the students did. And sound loud enough to disrupt them. There's some residual sound in the deafest of people. And they would sit there and go through these drills, and you would see them just be overwhelmed. And they did have an overwhelming task. It was before the cochlear implant, before amplification was as sophisticated as it is now. And I remember feeling that myself, just looking out the window and thinking, the ball game's only half an hour away. It's tricky. You want them to have what that can be. I'm not so sure if I hadn't had just one student, Carlos, I'd have never had it be in a classroom. And I would take him everywhere I could think of, rodeos, picnics, boating trips, so he had to get the language of a new situation.
There was a... there's this moment you write about where you kind of see now the complexity in who he is. It's a moment where he steals $20.
Yes.
And his teacher, Marion, a good friend of yours, she's a great character in the book, by the way. Really complicated in some ways.
Yes, very bright.
I would like to have known her. Oh. Aloof, I think, is how you've described her at one point, but also really caring. I mean, she's an interesting person. But Carlos steals $20 from her. And and you and Marion confront him. And I wanted you to talk about what happens, because really what he does is he tears off into the foothills.
I didn't want to see Marion confront him. I was sure he hadn't taken the money, and I didn't want to be pulled into it, and I tried to get out of there. I'm sure I wanted to preserve the dream of this child. And she takes the $20 bill from his pocket, and she wanted to make it memorable to him, so it's broad, obstreperous, you know. She scolds him, rails at him. And I watched. It's the only time in my life I've seen it, too. Someone confront the reality they'd kept from themselves. He believed he hadn't taken the money. I'm as certain of that as anything, that he didn't see what he wished to be had to be the truth. And suddenly that split in two, and he turns and runs, and he just tore up through the foothills of Ogden toward up. The School for the Deaf is close, and you could see his black hair flying, and I thought, he'll be up there for 2 weeks. He's going to be living on rabbits. He's going to make a fire and roast rabbits and stay up there until he can heal this rift in himself. And I went that night. Marion said, I don't want to go to his mother's house. Will you?
Yeah.
She was heavily invested in him, but I was someone she liked to send as the emissary. And I was went to say, Lily, Carlos ran away. And she had a wonderful speech. I loved to imitate her. She didn't sound like anyone I'd ever heard. She said, I don't know what's the matter with that boy. And I said, do you think he'll be okay? She says, yeah, he's fine, but he don't want to be bothered. I said, he's here? She says, yeah, he came right home. So he'd gone to ground. He'd gone to his most native place and didn't want to be bothered. That would be how he handled a highly emotional situation. When I left for Montreal and I left without him, it was the same. It was he don't feel good today.
Yeah.
And so then you wait to see, will he come back to school? I like what you're getting at. This shows some of what you've asked about and I've tried to respond to, that there were so many levels in him and so many things you don't usually see nakedly in someone, if at all.
Yeah. And some not attractive, some unappealing, some,
yes,
some violence.
Yeah,
some.
Yeah. He came out of roughness. He told me he'd seen a baby murdered. He lived in the river bottom, and he could go from being the best-looking kid in the class and the cleanest. I was ironing a fresh shirt every day for school. No, I wore that. I can't wear that one again. To just a little ruffian. And he was large. He contained multitudes.
There's a moment when he writes a note to you. I will wife you. Explain that, because I'm trying to get at how it is you define that relationship. Because you say in the book, you say, many years passed before it seemed quite natural to me that Carlos and I should have been a little in love with each other for a time.
The Pygmalion.
Yeah, the Pygmalion.
So was, invested.
Yes, because yes. You say, but I came to see that we were destined to lose our hearts to our Pygmalions.
You know, we were good together. We had just huge amount of fun together. We were both outrageous. So we could just never tire of topping each other. And no one was quite as interesting to me. I also say in the book, I was about to marry a man there, happened to have the same name, Carl, and Carlos dominated the time. I mean, it was pretty clear to me that Carlos was just so interesting to me. But it's one thing when you're 10, he's 10, and you're 24. But he became 16 and then 17. And I knew he was fascinated with me. That was mutual. But you could see that you can't go into your adult life now being the only two things of predominant interest to each other. And he was smarter than I was in knowing it's time to walk away from that. His strength and decision in coming to Montreal and deciding I will go home, the big junctures of his life where he had to decide, should I have dialysis? He did that with enormous force and power. There's no back and forth. The morning I came out and that note was on the table, I will wife you, I count it as one of my really eloquent proposals.
Right.
I stood there looking at those words and I thought, oh, honey, how do we take you back now to the girls your age?
Yeah.
He'd say to me, why are you too old? It was complicated.
Yeah.
It was a many-dimensioned relationship, and we did exactly the right thing. We saved it.
And, of course, you mentioned he had renal failure. It was this Alport syndrome, something that you had identified, really, that you write about, this combination of deafness and early-onset renal failure. And you write about this in the book, and you write about going to visit Carlos in the hospital, and he said something interesting. He said, my body's almost a monster.
And he'd be funny with, my body's almost a monster. I said, your body's wonderful. You're still beautiful. He said, no. And he'd give me a tour, show me the scars for the fistula in the arms, in the elbow, in the ankle, the cuts for the two kidney transplants. He was bruised up and scarred up, and he'd taken prednisone by now for years, and he was swollen. He had lost his beauty. He looked like he was 78, and he was 33, and he'd liked being good looking. He'd comment on it, but his way of handling it was to be kind of funny about it. My body's almost a monster.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about the conversation you had with him on a visit to see Carlos. You went, and then you didn't. You went for a walk, not far from here, as a matter of fact, right, up by Red Butte Garden. But then you come back to the hospital, and you go to a bank of phones, and you call a Dr. Rachel Remen?
Rachel Naomi Remen.
Remen. And she asks you this series of questions. Why was he born, she asks. What is his purpose? There's another section here I want you to read, but tell me, what are the questions about first before you read this section?
I'd met her at a conference. I was director of women's programs at Westminster College, and she was a keynote speaker. And I broke my ethical standards and talked about my private life at the last of knowing her just for a moment. She was head of pediatrics at Stanford at that time. I didn't say more than, my boy is dying. And she took out a card and gave it to me and said, call me when you don't know what to do. It won't matter what time it is. She went on to be famous for what she's done in medicine, to write books like My Grandfather's Blessings. So the minute she heard my voice, she began to ask these questions. And that was all there was to the conversation, just her posing the questions that let me get to where he was. And I think that her intent was see him whole, see his whole life. And should I read from there?
Please.
So the question that Doug had read before my long digression, what is his purpose, she asked. And again I was still, watching in my mind the ancient human struggle of a boy coming to understand himself and to move beyond his limitations. It was all against the odds for Carlos. Yet triumph is the word that most comes to mind in thinking about his life. Without having heard language, he was a phrase maker. Without having had an advanced education, He became sophisticated in the most wonderful sense of the word. Without having had health, he lived fully and deeply. Without having had a merciful life, he was compassionate. Without having had money, he brought riches. With so much to endure, he did endure. Again, a question. What are the qualities unique to him? He danced before my eyes as rare and brilliant as a field of wildflowers. Wherever he was and in whatever condition, he provided a gathering place for laughter and camaraderie. Once he had surprised me with the gift of a miniature cast iron stove like the one my grandmother had had in the cabin at the sawmill. "Why are you giving me a present?" I asked. "For love," was his answer. Again, Rachel asked a question and waited. "Has he finished?" For the first time in looking at his altered life, I could acknowledge the possibility that he might have, but that I didn't know, I wouldn't know. She asked a last question. "What is the worst thing he can lose now?" I knew it wasn't his life. Rachel said it better than I ever could have. "Your work, Jerry, is to take care of his spirit, to keep him close to his identity. That's your part. Keep seeing his strength, his spirit, and reflect these back to him. You must say to yourself, 'I am a friend of this young man's soul. How am I going to let this help him keep what he is?' Use your knowledge of this man. You have the peace that no one else has."
Let me ask you this finally. You write in the book that you were there. You were the one they asked if they should turn off the machines. He was in a coma. You were the one that said yes. And then the nurse offered you this opportunity to go and see his body, to have your goodbye, as she put it. And you didn't go. And you say in the book there was too much left in the memories. You didn't want that kind of closure, you say. And you say this: you don't regret that. You don't regret going to... And here's how you put it. You said it kept him as immediate as a piece of music played for all it's worth. What did you mean?
I couldn't imagine overlaying the life, the presence of him with him being gone. And I think I'd said I didn't want any kind of closure with Carlos. I'm interested in that. I would go at my age now to see him and have my goodbye, but my goodbye was in Red Butte Garden in the foothills.
Jerry Parker, the book is 1,000 Voices, a memoir. Jerry, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.